Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And, you know, on Intelligent Medicine, we always try to bring you the latest information, timely information, information that relates to issues that are at hand. And I can't think of an issue that we've timed better than this upcoming interview, because many of you have been following with some dismay the case of 15-year-old Justina Pelletier, who is a child who was basically put on hold by the authorities in Massachusetts because one faction of her doctors disagreed with another faction of her doctors, and she was taken into foster care, and basically she was barred from having contact with her patients except for infrequent contact. You've seen this on Fox News. You've seen this on The Blaze. This is a hot story, and we have a very exciting new development that has just come across the airwaves. Today we're going to talk to an advocate who has been following this issue very carefully. She is Diane O'Leary. She's executive director of the Coalition for Diagnostic Rights. This is an organization that stands up for the rights of patients to obtain satisfactory diagnoses from their doctors, and much more. We'll find out about it in just a few moments. She is also a PhD in philosophy and a medical ethicist. So without further ado, Dr. O'Leary, can I refer to you as Dr. O'Leary?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, well, indeed, you earned your doctorate. Tell us a little bit about, tell us what the Coalition for Diagnostic Rights is about, and then we can get into the Justina Pelletier case.
Sure. The coalition was formed to address the recklessness of diagnosis of it's all in your head. So there are many labels for that. Somatoform disorder is probably the one most familiar. Now, since the DSM-5 came out, some people use somatic symptom disorder, conversion disorder, functional neurological disorder, functional symptoms, psychogenic. Some patients still call it hypochondriac. Any version of it's all in your head.
Right. So this is, in medicine, we refer to this as somatoform disorder. That's just a kind of a fancy phraseology, which means that your physical symptoms are an embodiment of basically a psychological disorder of depression. I mean, we know depressed people tend to be more achy. I mean, there's some truth to that, that there are somatic complaints of some psychological disorders.
Yes, certainly. We don't dispute that. We're not an organization standing against the idea that the body expresses the emotions that we have. We're standing against recklessness in diagnosis of it's all in your head. Generally speaking, the phrase medically unexplained symptoms is understood by doctors to mean symptoms that are caused by psychiatric problems. And it's that very quick leap, that indefensible leap from it's unexplained so it must be psychiatric, that is what we challenge. And it is that leap that threatens the medical care of patients who have confusing symptoms.
Well, this is of special interest to me because I often see patients who come to me after having been dismissed by the medical profession as having basically depression or fibromyalgia, told that they need to see a psychiatrist, they need to take antidepressant medications, but they may have a more complex series of underlying causes to their complaints, and we try to do detective work. And interestingly, the case of Justina Pelletier, I mean, I don't know the precise details, but she seems like exactly that type of patient, a patient who comes with a complex, mysterious disorder, and she did find an explanation from the initial experts, medical experts, not holistic doctors, not naturopaths, but doctors working in the Tufts Medical Center system in Boston, one of the finest medical centers in the world.
Yeah, that is the case. Justina Pelletier, before she came to Boston Children's and this case ensued, she was a patient of Dr. Mark Corson at Tufts, and he is a certainly world-respected expert in mitochondrial disease. She'd been in his care for about a year and a half, and the treatment had been quite successful. She was leading a very active life. Her sister also has mitochondrial disorder that's been verified with a muscle biopsy, and it's a genetic problem. And Dr. Corson at Tufts has also been caring for her.
So the treatment, from what I don't know the details of the treatment, but I know a little bit about mitochondrial disorders. The treatment often involves a combination of nutrients, such as coenzyme Q10, that's often used in mitochondrial disorders, but also certain medications. So she was really not just getting, going to a vitamin store and taking some hypothetical pep-up pills. She was really under an exacting form of medical care from an expert in this disease who's written scores of dissertations and papers, scientific presentations on the subject of this elusive, mysterious disorder.
Yes, that's exactly true. She had a long list of medications at the time she was admitted to Boston Children's. She had had a surgery performed for a problem with the colon. It was a kind of a brand new and quite groundbreaking surgery by Dr. Flores, who was at Tufts at the time and who had moved to Boston Children's Hospital. So when Justina developed the flu, Dr. Corson at Tufts said, take her to the emergency room at Boston Children's.
Right, and as something that I might do, on certain occasions, I might say, look, I can't see the patient today, and you're too far away, so just go to the emergency room and see what they have to say. So, he had no idea what was going to ensue after that innocent suggestion, just go to the emergency room, make sure she gets checked out.
Actually, it was even more specific than that. The doctor who had performed her colon surgery had moved from Tufts to Boston Children's.
Okay.
She was going to Boston Children's to specifically be admitted under the care of Dr. Flores, who had performed her GI surgery in the past.
Okay, and so totally reasonable suggestion. Make sure you get checked out because this is a child who is at risk. Ordinary child gets the flu. Maybe you can observe them for a while, but this is a child who could go downhill very fast if she were not looked at.
Yes, exactly right, yeah.
So what then ensued?
The parents arrived. Actually, it was just the mother at that time. It was 4 in the morning. There was a snowstorm, it's Boston. They arrived in the ER, and neurologists happened to see Justina first. She was sort of dazed and kind of out of it, which happens sometimes with her condition. And the neurologist considered her case and announced to the parents, reportedly, that they don't believe that there is such a thing as mitochondrial disorder and that they wanted to take a different treatment route. The mother thought, okay, you're doctors, you know what you're doing, and she didn't push too hard, so they did not admit her to see the doctor they came to see, Dr. Flores. They admitted her to neurology. They did not perform testing that would be standard for her condition. For example, she's had strokes in the past. They did not do brain tests, whether there had been stroke issues repeated. After a couple days of doing nothing and having a lot of psych evaluations, this is all as reported by the parents, of course, I haven't seen records. After a few days of that, they were approached with a care plan that said her medications would be withdrawn. There would be no further diagnostic investigations, and the parents were not allowed to consult any physicians outside the small team of neurologists and psychiatrists that was working with her. Also, the parents were forbidden to talk with her about the severity of her condition. The parents refused to sign that care plan, and as a result, Boston Children's called in the Department of Children and Families, who took custody on the basis of a charge of medical child abuse, because the parents insisted on medical treatment rather than psychiatric treatment for their daughter.
I can see what happened there. All of a sudden, a physician unfamiliar with the case took a different perspective on it. There is a condition, as you know, Dr. Leary, called von Munchausen's syndrome by proxy, which is parents who have deep psychological problems who project their mental problems on an unwitting child, and then it becomes a folie à deux, or it becomes a sort of a familial pathology, where the kid is trotted around from doctor to doctor to doctor, and sometimes the parents make it worse, either by encouraging the child to act in a sick way, or sometimes by literally harming or poisoning the child. I mean, that does happen. It's a rare condition, and clearly it's not applicable to this case, but I think that that's what they began to think. So they said, wait a minute, these parents are encouraging this young girl to believe that she has a terrible disorder. So let's isolate her from them. Let's also make sure that they don't read any more about weird disorders, that they don't talk to more doctors who might encourage them to pursue a medical diagnosis. And let's send this child to psych, and we'll have the shrinks talk to the child. Maybe we'll put the child on some psych meds to calm her down. I mean, I could see that unfolding any day of the week at a hospital where, anyone is at risk of having that happen to them.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's not an unreasonable thing to be concerned about. If they felt convinced that the child was not medically ill and they thought that there were signs there of medical child abuse, they were convinced of that. And in that case, it's appropriate to try to protect the child. However, there were a number of steps that they took at that time that very directly and egregiously violated the patient's rights of Justina Pelletier, which she hold, which her parents hold on her behalf. So before the Department of Children and Family was called in, the parents obviously still had the authority to make medical decisions for their daughter. And their choice of providers, their demand to see the physician she was supposed to be admitted to see, and their insistence later that she be transferred to Tufts, to her regular doctor, both of those decisions were just overruled by the doctors caring for her, for Justina at BCH, before custody was taken. So that's a very serious violation there. And in addition, the doctors then presumed that if the family couldn't make the decisions, the doctors themselves should make the decisions. And that violated Justina's right to a surrogate decision maker, and that is a very serious violation.
Well, clearly, we have some rights, I mean, with certain, limitations, obviously, on our right to seek medical care of our choice. I mean, we, to some extent, there's consensus in medicine about how to treat things, but there still is a great deal of controversy about how to treat certain disorders. The Pelletier case is a case in point, but another type of case might be someone who chooses to pursue an alternative cancer treatment, or a parent who, on behalf of a child, refuses a harsh form of chemotherapy or radiation, and instead attempts to access another type of therapy. In some cases, that's a mistake because the conventional treatment is going to be 97% effective, and it's delusional to think that by, taking herbs or putting the child on some sort of, strict diet, that's going to make the cancer go away. On the other hand, conventional treatments for many diseases fall way short of being effective, especially for, complex and mysterious diseases like mitochondrial disorders.
Yes, that's exactly true. So I think it's useful to notice that the situation you're describing where the doctors are saying a child needs a certain treatment and may die without it, and the parents are saying, no, we want to do a different thing that's less risky or alternative approach. In that case, that's a kind of a standard scenario where you would question parents' judgment and where it seems appropriate to question parents' judgment. But in this case, and in these kinds of cases, the scenario is actually reversed. It is the parents who are saying this child needs treatment, and it is the doctors who are refusing to treat.
Right.
The parents are meeting their ethical and legal obligation to provide necessary care for the child because there's a doctor who said she needs this care, and the parents are saying, yeah, I want her to have it. The doctor told me she needed it, and yeah, give it to her. And the medical child abuse suggests that the parents should have recognized the need to say, no, that doctor was wrong about the need for care, and this doctor is right. that she doesn't need care. And that's a very tricky thing to require of a parent.
Exactly. These parents are not refuseniks. They're not saying, there's nothing wrong with our child, let's not take her to the hospital, or let's not seek appropriate care. In fact, the opposite. They were very, very proactive on her behalf.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. That word refuseniks is really good. They were not saying, no, we don't like the treatment, no, let our daughter go. They were saying, please treat our daughter. And because they said daughter, she was taken into custody and held in a psych ward for a year.
For one full year. So this is all been transpiring across the media, and has been a firestorm of controversy, as Fox News in particular, Glenn Beck, have featured this story repeatedly, based on the notion that this is a violation of our rights as citizens to pursue the type of care that we believe is efficacious. And so for 1 year this has transpired, but there's been an astounding development, literally, within the last hour. For some of you who are listening, it'll be, the morning after, or maybe a couple of days after, but, what just transpired in this case that really is astonishing?
Yeah, what happened today, an announcement has just been made. There was a meeting of all the attorneys involved in the case this morning, and an announcement has been made that the child care, Justina Pelletier's medical care, will no longer be handled by Boston Children's Hospital, but will now be handled by her original physicians, her doctor's physicians of choice at Tufts.
Wow.
So this is basically an admission that the parents' rights to the doctor of choice was violated, and this is how we rectify it. We go back to the beginning, and we do what it is the parents said they wanted to do.
Well, this is
very good.
Very, very good news for people who believe in diagnostic rights. But it took so long, and it took a public outcry, and it also took, the father, he was very, 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 assertive on behalf of his daughter. In fact, there was a gag order that was placed on him, where he wasn't supposed to talk to the press about it, but he said, the hell with the gag order. I'm going to get on and broadcast the news about the fact that my daughter is being put on hold, and we're virtually, she's being held hostage virtually, and we can't even see her except in very, very restricted circumstances, short period of time under supervision every week, which is to, it would be to the detriment of any 15-year-old, much less a 15-year-old who is ill and, feels isolated and weak and now is deprived of parental contact.
Yeah, Lou made the decision that, they respected the gag order for a very long time, fearing that if they violated it, that would make it harder for them to earn their daughter back. But it became clear eventually that the court was just fuddling around and meandering and really not working toward bringing her home or getting her the medical care she needs. So Lou made the decision to go ahead and take it out to the court of public opinion.
Well, that was a tough decision because, you when you go on TV and, you're that passionate, and I watched him and I looked at him very closely. I looked at his eyes. I looked at his face and his expressions. And I thought to myself, is this guy a nutcase? Is he going on TV because maybe he's got some kind of secondary gain? He wants to make a big spectacle out of this. This is like creating a lot of drama in his life. But I saw it when I looked at him. I felt his sincerity. I felt his passion. I felt his despair at having his daughter taken away from him. And I think he communicated that very effectively, to the American public. And he actually helped to make this case into a cause célèbre, because if he hadn't done that, it may have been just swept under the rug and it could have dragged on for years. And maybe we never would have gotten to this, juncture where, the child was returned to appropriate care.
Yes, I think that's definitely true. It was astonishing to see how careful and controlled he was, in those interviews, because of course it's a severe trauma for all of the family, and any parent with a sick child that they cannot help is under severe duress. So yeah, it was quite a magnificent display of parenting, I think, the way that Lou handled that. Though I do think you're right that if he hadn't done that, if his face hadn't looked as genuine as it has, People might have swept this case under the rug and not taken notice, but I think that it's very important to recognize that while it wasn't the case here, if it had been the case that these parents were guilty of harming their child, if this was a very clear-cut case of medical child abuse and a very clear-cut case where the girl didn't need medical treatment but she needed psych treatment instead, these events would still be an atrocity. The violations of rights that occurred would be violations even in cases where the parents are guilty, even in cases where somatoform disorder is rightly diagnosed. Those kinds of diagnoses do not make it acceptable for autonomous patient decisions to be overridden. They do not make it acceptable for doctors to step in and take over patients' medical decisions rather than appointing a surrogate decision maker.
Well, I think
very important. Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think the analogy would be, you know, if an obvious murderer, you know, who's caught, you know, in flagrante delicto, you know, murdering someone, were taken to a jailhouse and they were taken, you know, by an unruly mob to a gallows and hung, you know, some people might say, well, it doesn't matter because the guy was clearly guilty anyway. But that's just a violation of due process, and the ends don't justify the means. And in order to protect our society, we have to have some really clear-cut checks and balances in place. Otherwise, abuses like this will happen all the time, and it could get worse. We could really have a medical police state.
That's exactly right. The phrase that we use at the Coalition is medical tyranny, and I think that that's a little bit scary for people. It's frightening to think of your doctors as not being on your side. But the reason that patients' rights exist is to ensure that the patient's decisions are the ones that matter at every step of the way. And the doctors essentially give expertise and advise, and the decisions are made by the patients. So the rights are what keep it from becoming, you know, a situation of tyranny.
Right.
In any situation where there's a huge inequity of power, that's where rights really matter. Because that's where rights are routinely violated. You know, the situation you raise with a murderer who is taken into custody. Say, for example, the murderer is an African American, and they bring him into the jail to be held for a hearing. The fact that he is a murderer, a known murderer, even in prison, let's say a convicted murderer, that doesn't mean it makes sense to make him use a segregated bathroom,
mm-hmm.
Right? It's inappropriate to violate his fundamental civil rights just because he's a murderer. And similarly, in the case of Justina Pelletier, the fact that there were questions about medical child abuse and somatoform did not in any way support violating the fundamental right to make decisions and the fundamental right to a surrogate decision maker. So those kinds of things are... It's very important for patients to be aware that they maintain those rights in these kinds of situations.
Well, you are executive director of the Coalition for Diagnostic Rights, and obviously that organization did not come into existence just in the past couple of weeks as the furor over Justina Pelletier's very notorious case made the headlines. Your organization has been around for a while. What type of cases similar to this or different from this concern you, and where do you see patients' rights being violated in other circumstances?
Well, there are a number of other cases in the media, but I suppose the important message here for the CDR is that this is a case of extreme, what we call denial of care, you know, where a patient who's ill is mistakenly denied care based on your head. But the problem of mistaken denial of care is actually epidemic. So let me give you a few figures that we have on that. The American Autoimmune Related Disease Association did a survey of patients with autoimmune disease, and that survey showed that 45% of patients who have autoimmune disease are mistakenly denied medical care because of wrong diagnosis of it's all in your head. 45%.
Wow. And that would mean millions of patients, right?
That number amounts to 22 million people denied care mistakenly in just that one category. So if you compare that to the total number of people affected by cancer, that's only 13 million. So the number harmed by this problem just with autoimmune disease is nearly double the total number harmed by cancer. That's how serious this problem is.
Well, it's also an issue that is related to sexual discrimination in medicine, because recently they've made a big to-do about, wear red for February for Women's Heart Month, because heretofore they've often dismissed women's atypical cardiac complaints as just hysteria, psychosomatic. You know, women don't necessarily get crushing left-sided chest pain radiating down their arm as a typical feature of a heart attack. And so they've tried to make doctors more aware that women can present in different ways because women weren't getting adequate recognition that they had real problems when they came in with bewildering complaints.
Yes, it's the situation you're raising there is really important because doctors do continue to believe, and there are studies to show that this is mistaken, but they do continue to believe that it's all in your head. Diagnoses apply almost exclusively to women. And on the score of heart disease, there's a really terrifying statistic there. The New England Journal of Medicine did a study that showed that in the under 55 age group, women who are in the middle of an active current heart attack are 7 times more likely to be mistakenly sent home from the ER than men.
Wow.
Yeah. That one is pretty terrifying. Once they're out of the ER, they are twice as likely to die.
Indeed. And, you know, and this is because of prevailing attitudes, which obviously they're trying to change. And maybe they're doing a better job in the cardiology field than they are in other fields. But there are many ailments, which I see that often get tossed off as, oh, you know, you're suffering from menopausal depression. You know, this is the way it is. You know, you're 45 or you're 52 or you're 61. And you know, that's sort of these ailments that you complain of. You know, they're just sort of, you know, part of life and, you know, we're not going to address them.
Yeah, it is very easy. In fact, it's just common. It's just normal practice for doctors to see women with vague complaints. You know, my back hurts, I feel tired all the time. And, you know, as a result, these women don't get testing and don't get the care they need. For example, I have systemic lupus and it takes an average of, last I heard, I'm probably update on that one, but last I heard it takes an average of 2 years for a woman with lupus to get diagnosed. And this is because for those 2 years, the doctor is saying, you're just nervous and you're just depressed and, well, you know, you're not happy at home. And
what's happening at home is often the question that's asked. You know, what's happening at home? Are you getting along with your husband? Or you know, are your kids driving you crazy? You know, what's, you know, that kind of thing. Get a housekeeper.
Yeah, exactly. And there is absolutely no foundation for that kind of move, much less for it to be the default approach. I mean, on this score, we don't need to point out to doctors that they need to think outside the box. What we need to point out is that they need to think inside the box. It's not medically defensible to be this reckless with it's all in your head. It's not rational, and it's not medically defensible. It's not safe.
You came up with an interesting statistic because, you know, when that family appeared in the emergency room and Justina had all these weird symptoms, they rendered a diagnosis of medical child abuse. And, you know, we tend to – what they said essentially is this mitochondrial disease is so rare, it's virtually non-existent. This can't possibly be the diagnosis. It's much more likely that this is an instance of medical child abuse. So we're going to go down that thought process with this patient. You actually compiled some statistics that show that mitochondrial disease may be vastly underdiagnosed and may be far more prevalent than we think.
Oh, yes, the comparison, I'm really glad you asked that question, because comparison of the figures on medical child abuse versus mitochondrial disorder are really telling. As I have been able to determine it, Munchausen by proxy, which is another name for medical child abuse, occurs with a prevalence of like of roughly one in 200,000. So it is very rare. On the other hand, mitochondrial disorder, it's the American Academy of Pediatrics states that it's, at this point, 2013, one in 5,000 as a prevalence. And that tells us that mitochondrial disorder, which many people consider, think is rare, it's not, but mitochondrial disorder is 40 times more common than medical child abuse. 40 times more common.
Right. And let me tell you that as a physician who recognizes this disorder, there are very, very few doctors who have a degree of sophistication and specialization to pick up this problem. It is not easy. The tests are complicated, sometimes hard to access. The ultimate test is a difficult test to perform, which is a muscle biopsy. That test is rarely done, but can be done in centers where they specialize in researching and treating this disorder. I recently attended a medical conference that was 3 days in duration, and the theme of that medical conference for 3 days with literally dozens of lecturers was mitochondrial disorders. And they vary because they're very extreme forms of mitochondrial disorder where children do not survive. They're so severely affected that they die, in childhood. But there are other forms of mitochondrial disorder that are subtle, difficult to discover, and they only emerge sometimes later in early adulthood, and they have subtle symptoms. And also we recognize that many, quote, standard disorders like diabetes or Alzheimer's disease may have components of mitochondrial disorder. So there's no real dividing line between you're perfectly normal or you have this dread rare disorder, mitochondrial disease. It's sort of a continuum.
That's my understanding of it, yeah. And there are some cases where people die, children die of this disorder, and then other cases where it's developed very slowly over a period of years. But I do want to say, I think that your approach to these kinds of questions, to the big gray area there in diagnosing mito, that it's not a yes-no, not an on-off, it's just kind of more like a dimmer, it's a gradual, it's a spectrum. I think your approach to these kinds of problems, these kinds of disorders, is just so refreshing and actually quite a relief to hear. When I hear you talk about these kinds of cases, I feel that it is possible for doctors to do this right. I spend so much of my time trying to suggest that people do it with the sort of openness that you naturally bring to it. I find it very refreshing to hear you your thoughts on how to approach mito or something along those lines.
Well, indeed. I think we sometimes refer to this as a functional medicine approach, which is not so much looking for boxes in which to put diseases, but to look at the functioning of the organ systems, the functioning of the cells. And, exactly as you say, it's not an on-off switch. It's a dimmer switch. Some people have it full bore, and they may, have profound mental retardation and die young. And other people may just have a variety of bewildering complaints that are really tough to pin down and that tempt doctors to label them as somatoform. Somatoform, generally, that diagnosis is rendered when you have so many complaints, so many, like an array of complaints that practically fill a page. That's when you're diagnosed as having a somatoform disorder. But the reason that they call coenzyme Q10 ubiquinone is because it's ubiquitous, and the mitochondria are ubiquitous. They are in every organ of the body. And so if you have mitochondrial problems, you can have problems with your brain, your heart, your muscles, your nerves. I mean, you name it. And, your digestive system, everything is on the fritz because the mitochondria produce energy in the body. Look, this is not an interview. I know you're not an expert on this disorder, but I just wanted to focus on that. Dr. Lear, you are a PhD in philosophy, and you specialize in the field of medical ethics. So, it's interesting. You're a philosopher. You say, well, that's what you said, when I spoke to you right before the show. You said, well, I'm a philosopher. Why do you think we need to get philosophers involved in our medical care? You think every hospital should have a group of, like in the Socratic tradition, like a bunch of philosophers wearing togas debating medical issues these days?
I like the idea of the togas. Yeah, there are philosophers. When complex issues come up in patient care, particularly in end-of-life care, it's common for doctors and patients to turn to a hospital ethics committee. And many of the people sitting on an ethics committee will be philosophers who specialize in ethics. And this is a very good thing, but it's problematic that these ethicists don't have much authority. They don't have any actual power to compel doctors to do things one way or another, so doctors tend to pretty much ignore them. They gesture in the direction of ethics, and then they do what they want instead. But you're raising another issue that, I really haven't been asked to address before, and I think it's important. The one thing that philosophers do, really the thing that philosophers do, is reason extremely carefully. And whether it's ethics or metaphysics, I was in metaphysics for a long time, regardless of which branch of philosophy, very clear reasoning is the guide. And it seems very clear to me that the diagnostic process is very much in need of some reasoning lessons.
Right.
The diagnostic process is just not rational much of the time. There are very easy ways to apply basic critical thinking or informal logic to reach safer results. So yeah, I think it would be terrific if there was a philosopher around when complex diagnoses are made.
Well, I think the key is the word independent. Because, many of the hospital ethicists they're basically employees of the hospital. And my concern is that, look, if you're an ethicist, clearly you've got ethics, but you have an implicit conflict of interest if you're working for the hospital. And with cost containment issues and end of life care issues coming up more and more as this medical system morphs into something that really has a lot of state control, I worry that government ethicists or hospital ethicists will have a bias towards, well, let's see if we can triage this patient or that patient because we gotta basically keep our healthcare system afloat.
That's a very, very important issue, I think. You are absolutely right that there's a conflict of interest for the ethicists who are employed by the hospital or by the medical center or by a university at large and then called into a hospital situation. That's just not working. You just cannot get an independent ethical assessment from somebody who's paid by one of the sides rather than the other. But I think it also speaks to a larger problem with the way ethics are handled in the medical world. When I first became involved in this kind of debate, in these issues, I had a hard decision to make about whether to start to work on publishing papers in bioethics and going to bioethics conferences and that sort of thing, or to do what I had already started doing, publishing things in the mainstream, doing work directly on the ground with patients, raising awareness about patients' rights. And I realized in that, when I had to make that decision, that I could not possibly have an impact on this problem as an ethicist in the system. Because the system isn't speaking to doctors, the system of ethics, medical ethics. Doctors are not hearing what gets said there. And more importantly, patients are not hearing what gets said there. Patients don't know they have rights. They don't know what the rights are. They don't know how to have them protected. And this is a dangerous situation. If everyone had been aware of patients' rights, this could not have happened to Justina Pelletier. So, yeah, I guess my picture is that it's time we take ethics to the place where it matters, to the streets, to the patients.
Well, we certainly need an independent voice for proper medical ethics, and a grassroots movement that's patient-centered and not necessarily government-centered or doctor-centered or hospital-centered, because goodness knows the gravitational pull is to more centralization and more authority, and which imperils individual rights. So congratulations to you, Diane O'Leary. Is there a call to action for our listeners, something that they can do to either inform themselves more or to get more involved in asserting their diagnostic rights?
Yes, definitely. Our site, diagnosticrights.org, contains listings of patients' rights, listings of frequent violations of patients' rights when you're considered for somatoform diagnosis, explanations of what denial of care is, discussions of other cases in the news. There are two other cases at the moment that are making headlines elsewhere, like Justina Pelletier's. All of these things are available at our site, diagnosticrights.org. And for those who feel this issue matters, join the coalition. You simply fill in the form and click the button, and you are a member of the coalition. So you are a part. You are one of the many voices that are coming together to say no to reckless denial of medical care.
Okay, or follow you on Facebook, or follow you on Twitter. You have a presence there. And what if you were a patient, somebody's listening to this, they feel that they or a family member has been denied their diagnostic rights. They've been a victim of a perfunctory diagnosis of, merely a somatoform disorder, and they don't feel that their medical concerns are really being taken seriously.
You know, I really wish, I hear that a lot, and I so wish that I could say, this is what you need to do and this will solve the problem. There are some things that you can do. You can be very calmly clear with your doctor about what your rights are and how they seem to have been violated. This is a wise approach. On the other hand, when you do this, your doctor will label you as a difficult patient.
Yes, indeed.
And this might make it more difficult for you to get care.
Yeah, it's a paradox.
It is. So the reality is that at this time, when patients take a stand about this issue, it's a risk. My suggestion would be to join us in making a very big public display to show them that the public will simply not tolerate this any longer. When we do that, then it can be safe to say to your doctor, I believe I have a right to a second opinion, or I am certain that it is my decision, not yours, which care I will receive, that sort of thing.
Okay, that sounds like very, very savvy advice. And I want to thank you, Dr. Diane O'Leary, Executive Director of Coalition for Diagnostic Rights. And I also want to congratulate you because you are part, just a part, but a significant part of the groundswell that returned Justina Pelletier to her family and to a correct course of medical therapy after a terrible, terrible ordeal.
Yes, though I'm sorry, I should clarify. Justina has not been returned to her family.
Oh.
She is still in the custody of DCS. Sorry, Justina has been returned to the care of Tufts, her original physician. So she's getting the medical care that she needs, and the custody issues are, I think it's really a state line issue. She's in Massachusetts, parents are in Connecticut. They're still working that out.
I think they're going to work that out, though. I think I think that the momentum is now towards a resolution of this case.
Yes, certainly it is. Yeah, it is most definitely a day to be celebrating. And I am very grateful to you for helping to spread the word about what that case implies for every patient.
Well, I thank you for being available on a day where there's a lot of news and with a very topical issue. Thanks, Dr. O'Leary.
Thank you.
You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcasts with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via a convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or, alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.